From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The mosquitoes that carry the Zika virus probably first came to North America on slave ships in the 1500s. The virus showed up for the current surge in the Western Hemisphere only last year. Now it's in 26 countries. Millions have been infected. Birth defects have everyone on high alert. But how will it really be stopped, and when and where? This hour on Point, taking on the Zika virus. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have you changed your travel plans? Looked at a map to see how far north this could come? Wondered how whole countries are supposed to stop having babies for 2 years? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. The first of this month, World Health Organization Director General Margaret Chan rang the alarm, said the most important protective measures are to control mosquito populations, prevent bites, but there's a crisis here.
I am now declaring that the recent cluster of microcephaly and other neurological abnormalities reported in Latin America, following a similar cluster of French Polynesia in 2014, constitutes a public health emergency of international concern.
Yes, I'd say there's international concern. Carnival going on in Brazil, they're pulling out all kinds of stops to try and address this, but how do you get the public really into it? CNN interviewed Carnival goers on Monday in Rio. Here's a guy saying that people are taking steps to be safe, but he sounded a little blasé, interpreted here by CNN.
Yes, we are worried, and we're taking precautions because of the virus, he insists, but not mosquito repellent.
No repellent, no.
And here is Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff calling on citizens last week to fight against Zika, interpreted by France 24.
We'll do everything, absolutely everything we can to offer support to the children affected by microcephaly and their families. We're mobilizing our public health system and our assistance clinics and all necessary resources to help the children.
Let's go straight to Rio, and Wera Davies is South America correspondent for the BBC. Wera Davies, thank you very much for joining us. Is Brazil getting on top of this? Are they doing everything that can and should be done?
No, I think is the short answer. The Zika virus was first detected here in May of last year. It probably arrived a few months later, maybe during the Soccer World Cup the year before, or perhaps in some obscure boating event in which there were several competitors from the South Pacific, and they may have inadvertently brought the Zika virus with them. Since then, it's exploded like wildfire across Brazil and, of course, other parts of South America. It's estimated there have been a million sufferers of Zika in Brazil, perhaps more. Now, the disease itself doesn't have that strenuous or overtly bad symptoms. People come out in a rash. There's some scratching and itching, some vomiting and nausea. The problem is, of course, it's this link with microcephaly, this suspected link between Zika and this very damaging condition in babies, where babies are born with abnormally small heads, abnormally small brains. Now, anecdotally, there have been 4,000 cases of microcephaly in Brazil in the last year. They're still going through those cases to find out how many cases are linked to Zika. But if this link between Zika and microcephaly is proven, then I think it becomes very serious indeed, because Zika is spreading almost out of control in Brazil at the minute.
Feels very serious already. Here, just earlier this month, interviewed with Euronews, a pregnant woman in Brazil talked about the precautions she's taking.
Daily and every 20 minutes, I apply insect repellent. I try to wear long clothes, but in this heat, it is very difficult.
Of course, long sleeves, long clothes in the heat in Brazil in summertime, that doesn't sound fun. What about the Summer Olympics here? End of January, the mayor of Rio, Eduardo Paes, said precautions being taken to ensure the Olympic Games will take place as planned in August. Interpreted here by Deutsche Welle.
I don't think that this Zika virus situation is a problem for the Olympics. The month where the Olympics takes place, August, is a month where you don't have a proliferation of mosquitoes.
Okay, maybe. Wera Davies is in Rio for the BBC. We had Hope Solo, a big American soccer player, saying that if she had to decide today, she wouldn't be going to Rio. Are the games in trouble because of Zika, Wera?
The games themselves aren't in trouble, but the organisers here are putting their faith in two things. It'll be the winter here when the Olympic Games take place, and that is not the most active season for mosquitoes, although they are still around. The other thing is this public awareness to try and get people to use mosquito repellent. This coming Saturday, there'll be 200,000 soldiers on the streets of Brazil trying to raise public awareness. But Rio, for example, is a city with chronic pollution problems. Water quality here is poor, and I would be very surprised if any pregnant women athletes or female athletes hoping to become pregnant were to be here for the game. That's certainly the advice that a lot of broadcasters, a lot of companies working in Brazil are giving out to people. Of course, some people like the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta have already advised that pregnant women should not come to Brazil or other countries like Colombia and El Salvador, where there are very many cases of Zika. Brazil itself hasn't given that advice yet. The 2016 Olympic organizers haven't given specific travel advice to pregnant women or women hoping to become pregnant. I think that if the Zika crisis does deepen, does worsen, and if this link, this suspected link between Zika and microcephaly is proven, they may have to reconsider that travel advice.
Weird Davis, you cover all of South America for the BBC. Is this turning into a problem for the continent, people not coming to all kinds of destinations that are popular, normally popular travel destinations, because of this fear?
There is, of course, the great fear that this might hit tourism, which is a huge industry in Brazil, in Colombia, in the Caribbean. There are 20 countries across the Americas now where Zika has been detected. Some countries have taken more drastic action than Brazil, even though they don't have any cases of microcephaly yet, like Colombia and El Salvador have both made recommendations for women to seriously consider not getting pregnant for at least 6 months. Now, that is an almost impractical possibility. First of all, about 50% of pregnancies are not planned. They happen. And also, what do you do? I mean, how do you tell an entire country not to have babies for 6 months, up to 2 years? So that kind of advice hasn't been given in Brazil yet, but it is going to have an impact. Having said that, it was quite interesting. We just had Carnival finishing today in Rio and across Brazil, and Carnival numbers were not down. A lot of people seem to be taking a laissez-faire attitude to Carnival. Yes, they were using more mosquito repellent, but Carnival numbers were not down in Brazil at all.
We're going to talk in this hour to someone who's looking at the virus itself, to someone who's looking at how we get on top of the mosquitoes that carry it, to someone who's looking at what do we do with pregnancy and trying not to have so many pregnancies while the threat is there. Weira Davies, the South America correspondent for the BBC, has joined us from Rio. Weira, thank you so much for taking a minute to be with us today.
My pleasure, Tom. It's been a pleasure, because this is one of those things we know little about. The Brazilian government have admitted they don't know how the Zika virus acts on the human body. There's no vaccine. A vaccine might take 10 years to find, so there's a lot more we don't know about Zika yet.
We're diving in, learning right here and right now. Weira Davies, BBC, thank you so much. On Monday, one Carnival goer told CNN's Nick Payton Walsh, that she'd been infected with Zika before and was taking all possible precautions. Now, scientists think but can't prove that if you've had it once, you won't get it again, but she was not plugged into that.
The only people who really understand Zika, she says, are those who've already had it. The attitude on the streets now is wrong. If the country ignores it, it makes it worse. I'm taking my attitude home with me. I've brought nets. I don't want the mosquito to beat me again, to beat my family again.
Let's look at this virus. Andrew Pekosh joins us right now from Baltimore, Maryland, virologist, molecular microbiologist, director of the Center for Emerging Viruses and Infectious Diseases at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Andrew Pekosh, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Can we just speak to that issue first? If you get it, is it once and done? If you get it, you don't get it again?
So we don't have any data to support that yet. But
boy, I've heard that all over the place.
Well,
I've even heard people say, hey, I'm not going to be pregnant anytime soon. I'm going to go down now and see if I get it. Then I won't have to worry in the future.
There are so many unknowns about this virus, because previous to 2007, we had a handful of cases in Africa and Asia. They were cases that were usually diagnosed at the time of symptoms or long after a person was sick. And so we really don't understand much about the ecology of this virus, how it circulates, and the disease itself.
10 years to get a vaccine, our BBC correspondent was suggesting there. Does that ring true to you? You're the expert here.
It takes a long time to develop vaccines. One also has to remember we're probably talking about vaccinating pregnant women. That is a very, very difficult population to perform clinical trials in and to show efficacy in. So, and
because they're vulnerable, you don't want to take chances.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Pregnant women are a population that we want to really make sure are being treated fairly and well. And we don't usually include them in any kind of clinical studies because of the fact that they're pregnant and carrying a fetus with them.
Why just pregnant women? I mean, we've heard it can be transmitted with saliva, maybe even sperm, semen. So why just vaccinate women, pregnant women?
Well, the transmission via non-mosquitoes is really minimal.
Okay,
so there
good.
Have been a few cases of transmission via sexual contact. Virus is present in saliva and urine, but it's not clear if there's enough virus there to actually transmit anything. We're really talking about transmission via the bite of the mosquito that the vast, vast, vast majority of cases are acquired by.
How did this show up so suddenly? Has this been producing microcephaly all over the place in the world or in Africa and Polynesia before? Or, I mean, it just seems like it's exploded into our consciousness.
It really has. Part of this is because we've never had a large enough sampling of cases to really find some of these rare events like a potential link to microcephaly, a potential link to the neurological syndrome, Guillain-Barré syndrome, because there have been too few cases to detect the small number of these kinds of side effects. So a lot of it now is new because we're seeing so many cases and are able to capture some of these other side effects of the infection.
Andrew Pekosh in Baltimore, please stand by there. Virologist, molecular microbiologist. We've got a lot to learn here. We are talking about tackling the Zika virus and what that is really going to take. Sound behind us here of carnivals just wrapped up in Rio. Lots of people in the streets. Of course, the mosquitoes are there too. And the virus is very much there too. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about tackling the Zika virus, what it's really going to take at the viral level, at the mosquito level, and when it comes to human reproduction. Women have been asked in some places to not have babies for 6 months, for even 2 years. Carnival music behind us there from Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, has really struggled with this. And, of course, lots of people out in the streets there, mosquitoes out as well. We're going to look in this hour at what it's going to take to get a handle on mosquito populations that might carry this virus, at the challenges of putting the brakes on reproduction for an extended period, and, of course, at the virus itself. You can join us. What's your question on Zika? How it moves? How it works? Have you changed travel plans to Latin America? Do you think this will come to mosquitoes in the United States? How far north? Are you worried already in Florida, on the Gulf Coast? Are you dumping water out of nooks and crannies in the backyard? With Andrew Pekosh, he's a virologist, molecular biologist at the Center for Emerging Viruses and Infectious Diseases at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Andrew, questions for you from our listeners. Spartanburg, South Carolina. Bill is calling. Bill, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Thank you, Tom. If once you've had the virus, a female, does the virus always live in her body, or does after a certain incubation period, is she okay to get pregnant then?
It's a great question. Something else, Bill, as well?
Yeah, just if like some kind of stress or environmental factor could make it come back to you, like you know how chickenpox will turn into in older life when you get
into shingles, yes.
Shingles, yeah, of course,
shingles,
of course.
Yes.
Bill, we've got it. We've got Thank both. Andrew, what do you say?
So when we've looked at people who've been characterized early in the infection, it looks like the virus is cleared from your blood within a reasonable period of time, 7 to 10 days. What we don't know is how long this virus hides in other areas, like in saliva and urine, and we don't know if under certain conditions, like perhaps pregnancy, the virus that's in those areas can come back in the blood and invade the fetus. So it's in terms of a normal infection, you're probably free of the virus within 7 to 10 days. But in the context of a pregnant woman, we haven't studied that carefully yet, so we don't know.
Well, let's just stick with this for a minute. This is a big deal for people listening. So if you get the Zika virus and maybe you get the rash, maybe you get the flu-like symptoms, and it passes. And now, I don't know, 6 months later, or you name the time, you want to have a baby. Is that safe?
Well, one can go in and get tested to make sure that the virus is clear from your system. That's one good thing to do. Right now, I think the pause on this is because we really don't know anything about how long of a risk factor it is for a pregnant woman or for a woman before she can get pregnant. So lots of question marks here. I think there's an overabundance of caution here just because we really, really want to keep this population, pregnant women, as safe as possible and take as much precautions as possible to avoid this terrible microcephaly.
But I want to be – we'll look at that, but I want to be really careful here because what I hear you saying is if you get it once, you may carry a risk of microcephaly for the rest of your reproductive life?
So that's not true.
Be real clear.
Yes. So the virus is cleared from your blood relatively quickly. What we don't know is how long it stays in other parts of your body.
Yeah.
So we really need to study how long it's present in your saliva, how long it's present in your urine, and in those types of tissues.
So you don't know when the risk goes away at this point?
At this point in time, no.
Wow. That's pretty intense. I mean, that could mean, and I realize you don't know, so, but that could mean a long-term threat or risk related to pregnancy after getting the virus.
It could potentially mean that. Now, I think that the link to microcephaly is still one that is a little bit tenuous. So we really don't know how frequently – well, number one, we don't really have a firm link between the infection and microcephaly. And we also don't know how frequently microcephaly would happen in a Zika-infected pregnant woman. So these are all things that we really have to spend some time now and really carefully understand. It may be a very rare condition that only happens in a very small number of pregnant women. Until we firm those numbers up, I think all government agencies are trying to be as cautious as possible to minimize this risk.
Of course, we've got Zika virus now found in more than a dozen states in the U.S. The latest report out of Alabama, a travel-related case of Zika virus in an Alabama resident. All kinds of ways for this to move. Doesn't have to be the mosquito. People just coming home from travel. Osama in Omaha, Nebraska. Osama, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
It's my pleasure. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My wife is 6 months pregnant, and she is in Pakistan right now.
Okay.
The town she lives in has a lot of mosquito problem. Provided that they don't have Zika virus over there, I am kind of in a dilemma. Like, should I bring her back to Omaha, Nebraska, and have her deliver the baby, even though, you know, there's no Zika virus over here and there are no mosquitoes over here? Because it's not in Pakistan yet, but it's only a matter of time. If it spreads, I don't think they're equipped well. So I'm kind of in a dilemma. Should I bring her back over here?
Okay, Osama, hang on for a second. Let's be very clear here. Andrew, you hear the question, but as far as I know in all the reports, we do not see Zika virus in mosquitoes in the United States at this point, and certainly not in Omaha, Nebraska.
Exactly. Your point about travel-related cases is the important one. All of the cases that we've had in the United States have been associated with travel to areas that are affected by Zika, and there's an incredibly high probability they were all acquired via a bite of an infected mosquito. The only exception to this right now is the one sexually transmitted case in Texas.
Right, but that's not.
But
mosquito.
Even that, the primary case was linked to someone who traveled to an area where Zika is.
So put yourself in Osama's shoes. His wife is 6 months pregnant in Pakistan. Now, the latest map that I see from the CDC shows Zika virus in India, but not in Pakistan. Of course, geez, they're right next door. He's trying to figure, have her stay in Pakistan and deliver, or come back to Omaha, Nebraska. If it were you and money, let's say money were no object, what would you do, Andrew?
There are more important things to consider than Zika virus if you're in Pakistan or in the United States right now. It would be my simple question.
Meaning,
the simple answer to her.
Meaning traveling at that stage and so on.
Yeah, Zika is not a big risk for anybody in Pakistan right now, nor is it a big risk of acquiring it here in the United States.
We want to look at the mosquito issue as well. Andrew, stand by. Megan Wise de Valdez joins us right now from San Antonio, Texas, biologist, zoologist, expert in mosquitoes and mosquito-borne illnesses at Texas A&M University in San Antonio. Megan Wise de Valdez, thank you for joining us.
Hi, thanks so much for having me today.
Our caller in Omaha says that, the town his wife is in Pakistan has mosquito problems, but that, I presume, does not necessarily mean you've got the kind of mosquito, and it's a very specific kind that carries Zika.
Right. So Aedes aegypti is the mosquito that is the primary vector of Zika right now in Brazil and is the one that will probably be the mosquito vector coming up through the United States if it does pass through that border. So in Pakistan, there is Aedes aegypti, and I don't, as far as I know, they haven't isolated Zika from any mosquitoes there. As far as whether or not she comes back to Omaha, well, I can tell you for sure that Aedes aegypti is not in Omaha, so she's probably pretty safe as far as coming back.
I'm looking at this world map now, and of course you've got Brazil and up through northern South America, up through Mexico and a fair amount in the Caribbean. Then you've got this cluster in West Africa around Nigeria and so on. Then you've got the Uganda, where Zika was originally, I guess, is named for a forest in Uganda and a bit more in East Africa. And then India, Southeast Asia. It's showing Vietnam on the CDC map here, Thailand, Cambodia, Indonesia, a little bit of New Guinea, the Philippines. What are the odds of this getting into mosquitoes in the United States at this point, Megan?
That's actually a really good question. So, you know, mosquitoes really know no borders. And Aedes aegypti is right across the border from Mexico. Me being in Texas, I sort of take this really personally.
Yes.
But the issue is there's been a lot of studies on dengue and chikungunya, which are also transmitted by Aedes aegypti.
Okay.
And it is just amazing that although mosquitoes know no border, it seems like the diseases do know a border. And that really plays a big role. And the biggest role that is the factor there is a lot is the socioeconomic factors of the two countries. So where there are homes where there's not a lot of screening or air conditioning, there's not a lot of governmental support or mosquito control, that's usually right across the border from us here in Texas and Mexico. So they have shown that socioeconomic status plays a big role in whether the disease actually makes it here.
I mean, you've talked about dengue being right across the border from Texas, endemic in Mexico, and just not in Texas. It can make that big a difference, just these screens and socioeconomic factors.
That's right. So there have been some locally acquired cases of dengue and chikungunya in Texas and then, of course, Florida. So it does happen, but because we do have such great control here in the States, an epidemic type of pattern doesn't really occur here that much. That doesn't mean we can ignore the fact that it could potentially be here. I think it's the fact that we haven't ignored it in the past.
Let's go to Corey calling from Savannah, New York. Corey, thank you for calling. You are on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me. My question, because in New York, we've had a long history of West Nile being transmitted via mosquito. I know that the two are not related, but my question is, how do these viruses end up being mosquito-borne as opposed to other forms of transmission?
I'll take that to both my guests. Andrew, first to you.
It's really the fact that mosquitoes are incredibly good vectors in terms of moving, getting blood samples. They then become infected by the virus, and then when they take a second blood meal, can transfer that virus to another host. So that mosquito is a perfect little syringe to be able to move this virus to other hosts.
And so on it goes. I mean, really as simple as that. They're the ones who go in for the blood and move right on. Brianna, calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Brianna, you're on.
Hi, thanks for having me, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious about the links between microcephaly and Zika, and more specifically, if there's any statistics on how many of the babies, where the babies are from. Are they all in Brazil? And if so, is anyone looking at perhaps the link to the vaccination that was mandated last year by the Brazilian government for all pregnant women to get Tdap? And if that could be a link to microcephaly. I know it's a controversial topic, but just wanted to ask if anyone has any thoughts on that.
Andrew, thank you. Yes, thank you, Brianna. Andrew, to you again.
I think all countries that have Zika infections going on right now are addressing this issue of how closely they can link Zika infection with microencephaly. I think in Brazil, where we've seen the most talk about this, there's a confounding factor that there have been a greater emphasis on identifying microencephaly cases along, at the same time as Zika has been emerging. So it's not clear whether we're detecting a much larger number of microencephaly cases and how much of that is linked to Zika. All those things are being worked out in all the countries that have been Zika positive up until now.
Cecilia in Hartford, Vermont. Cecilia, you're on.
Hi, Tom. I'm calling because I and my family are trying to decide whether to book tickets to Puerto Rico for April.
Okay.
And it's just a month and a half away. It's time to make reservations, and I've really been on the fence about whether to do so. I am not planning to become pregnant. I have an 8-year-old daughter, and it would be the two of us and my husband.
How old are you, Cecilia, if I may ask?
I'm 48.
Okay. So are you planning on having more kids?
No.
Okay. Megan, what do you say?
Well, I can tell you that I'll be going to Guatemala in about 3 weeks with my family, and I have a 10-year-old daughter and an 8-year-old son with Down syndrome. So I think that we will be going, but
are you going for fun or work?
Well, half of my family lives down there through my husband's side. And so, yeah, we'll be going for fun. But I know currently that my relatives there are choosing to stay at higher altitudes and not going down to the lower altitudes because they had a huge problem with chikungunya last year or a few years back. So we will be going, but we will be using insect repellent, long pants, and really it comes down to personal protective measures.
But, I mean, you've got an important reason for going. You've got immediate family that's there. For many people, and I don't know about Cecilia, but for many people it's rather optional. Do you foresee Americans just traveling less to Central America, the Caribbean, Latin America in the potentially years ahead?
Well, I can't really speak to that, but
well,
think
you know where the mosquitoes
that,
are, and you know what
right,
the risk
that's
is.
True. Regarding the risk,
and people don't go on vacation to wear long pants. Most of them from going there from the U.S.
Unfortunately, you're right. I don't know if they'll be traveling less. I think that the media has helped to educate people, whether it's education all the way or sometimes a little bit of I don't want to I
scare.
Think,
I mean,
scare. Yeah, I don't want to say that we're trying to scare people. We're saying exactly what we know and what we don't know. I think that Andrew brought up some really good points. There's a lot of things that we don't know, and you have to take that into consideration.
Andrew, when are we going to know for sure, if you can estimate, whether microcephaly is confirmed to be a consequence in some cases of Zika?
My guess is that within the next month or two, we'll start to hear from various government agencies and state agencies with respect to how closely they can link Zika infection with pregnancies, because all the state and government public health agencies are addressing this. They're working day and night to try to get an answer to this as fast as possible. But let's put this back into perspective. We talked about travel, right?
Yeah.
So for the vast majority of people, if you get infected with Zika, you probably won't even know you were infected because most infections are symptomless. Somewhere in the range of, let's say, 20 to 30% of the infections, you come down with a rash. Which, of course, is problematic, but it's also not a life-threatening rash. So for the vast majority of people, that's what the risk is. I think that's what people have to then use in terms of making their own personal decisions, whether they want to travel to these countries. There are lots of other pathogens in these countries that have to worry about. Megan mentioned chikungunya and dengue. There's malaria in certain places. So there's a whole host of pathogens that people have to worry about when they travel. This is just one of them. They have to realize what the risk is to them and then make their own decisions accordingly.
Megan, can we sort of take the Aedes aegypti mosquito out of the U.S.? Is that possible to do or not?
Well, that's another interesting question. So Aedes aegypti is technically an invasive mosquito. As you said, it came over in the 15th through 17th centuries with those slave trade trips. And if we did take it out of the environment here, if that was even possible, first of all, it won't be an ecological catastrophe. But second of all, it would be very, very difficult to do because Aedes aegypti mosquitoes love to breed in those tiny little containers that you don't know you even have filled with water in your own backyard.
So, even in sprinkler system heads, sprinkler heads, oh my goodness. Megan Wise Valdez in San Antonio, Texas, please stick with us. We've got questions for you. Andrew Pekosh, please stay if you can. It's great to have you here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
This On Point podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you have a passion that you obsess over, if it keeps you up at night, if you live for it, you should show it off. With easy-to-use tools and templates, Squarespace helps you showcase every detail of what drives you. Because if it's worth the effort, it's worth showing to the world. Start your free trial today. Visit squarespace.com/onpoint. That's squarespace.com/onpoint. You should. Squarespace.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about really tackling the Zika virus, what it's going to take at the viral level, at the mosquito level, and when it comes to human reproduction. You can join us this hour. What do you think? How will this be stopped? Will you go to the Olympics in Rio this summer? Can you imagine being a woman in a poor village in El Salvador, Guatemala, being told, don't have a baby for 6 months, for 2 years? How's that supposed to work? Andrew Pekosh is with us from the Center for Emerging Viruses and Infectious Diseases at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Megan Wise de Valdez is with us. She's at Texas A&M University in San Antonio, Texas. Carl Kendall joins us in just a moment from Tulane University's School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine in New Orleans. Florida Governor Rick Scott has declared a health emergency in Miami-Dade, three other counties in Florida, because of the Zika virus that allows the state to ramp up its mosquito spraying program. Here's an unnamed state official talking with CBS Miami.
If we do appropriate mosquito control, we're not going to be seeing a massive outbreak in South Florida. If we don't, then we're in for trouble.
Megan Wise de Valdez in San Antonio, Texas. In this country, what will appropriate mosquito control look like?
Well, first and foremost, because Aedes aegypti breeds in containers, anything that can hold water in and around your home, not in your home, but around your home, the first thing that needs to happen is education, and that is to empty your vessels in the backyard, whatever it may be, at least once a week. So if you have a bird bath or something like that, it would have to be once a week. But that's primary, because one of the problems with spraying and larval control, which are classic techniques, is that because Aedes aegypti breed in these more hidden areas, it's more difficult to control. So the spraying only gets the adults. And adults tend to, they're daytime biters, so the classic spraying at night that most control for West Nile that occurs just doesn't work as effectively with Aedes aegypti. So
the big truck going down the street, fogging the whole thing, is that part of the picture or not then?
Well, I think it's going to have to be part of the picture. There is no one magic bullet to control Aedes aegypti, and that's why Aedes aegypti has been studied so much in terms of control and trying to find novel methods of controlling it. It's why the whole GM mosquito thing came about. We just simply don't have a great way to control except for removing standing water, and in places where people rely on stored water or things like that, not here in the States, of course, but that's why it becomes such a big problem.
Talk about the genetic modification that you and others are involved in with mosquitoes and how that might be an intervention to reduce the Aedes aegypti population.
Well, so my experience was with the group from around 2005 to 2010, and I was part of the first cage trials in the lab and then semi-field conditions in Tapachula, Mexico. These were some of the first prior to the field releases in Malaysia, Cayman Islands, and Brazil. But the way that works, just to refamiliarize everybody with it, is that the males are carrying a dominant lethal gene. So when they mate with the females, it's either the offspring that aren't viable, or in the case that I studied or I worked with, the resulting females couldn't fly. And if you can't fly, you can't bite, and only females bite.
So you're engineering males who, in effect, once they get out into the population, lead to stop reproduction one way or another.
Correct. And that is thought to reduce the population size. So some studies have already been done in Brazil. This was prior to the outbreak of Zika, but they had shown some 80 to 95% reduction in a set local population. So that's the key there, is that it would have to be a local population. The other thing one has to consider with genetically modified mosquitoes and releasing them is, of course, the community outreach. The people need to know what's going on, because it can be scary when you think of releasing thousands of males three times a week, and people might not know that males don't bite, or how can it affect them. But that usually isn't going to be the only thing that's going to work. It has to be in conjunction with some other forms of control to really reduce those population sizes.
Is this going on now? At what scale and where?
Right now, so they're working, well, believe it or not, they're working on something in Key West, waiting for some approvals there, because there were some locally acquired cases of dengue there.
And dengue is close to Zika, or the same mosquitoes carry it.
The same mosquitoes carry it, right? Mm-hmm. So as far as currently in Brazil, to respond to this particular outbreak, I'm not aware of any that's going to be happening, because, of course, that community outreach really needs to happen before anything is released.
It's been engineered. Let's go to Los Angeles, California, and Saad. Saad, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom. I have three quick questions for the guest. First one is, do we know which trimester women are more vulnerable or susceptible to having the birth problems with the virus?
Yep.
Second question is, the virus, does it affect the growth of the brain tissue itself or the skull that basically encloses the brain? And if that doesn't develop, the brain will not develop. And my third question is, what about newborn babies? Are they at a risk neurologically from having any consequences if they get infected?
Andrew?
So I'm going to have to give you a lot of we don't know. In terms of the pregnancy term, there have been cases that have been documented where infection in the first term has led to cases of Zika. So we're pretty sure that early on there is a sensitivity, but we don't know if there's a higher or lower sensitivity in other terms. With respect to the fetus, we don't have much yet in terms of any kind of reports of what the virus is doing there, but more than likely it's infecting cells of the central nervous system and therefore thereby preventing the central nervous system from developing, which is leading to these diseases. In terms of newborns, there's been no data whatsoever in terms of the susceptibility of newborns to Zika virus infection. So it's, again, an area that needs to be studied more.
Saad, glad to have your call from Los Angeles. Andrew, Megan, please stand by. Carl Kendall joins us right now from New Orleans, director of the Center for Global Health Equity at Tulane University School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine. He's a health anthropologist, has done a lot of field research in Latin America, Puerto Rico, Honduras, Cuba, Brazil, Peru, Guatemala. Carl Kendall, thank you very much for being with us today.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
We've heard these calls saying in Central America, women of childbearing age don't have babies for 6 months or 2 years. How on earth? I mean, we know, of course, technically you could do birth control, but, you know, population wide, is that realistic?
Yeah, I don't think that's a very realistic recommendation. You've heard Andrew and Megan talk about what we know and don't know about Zika and transmission. So it's difficult for me to imagine a group of people sitting around a table thinking about recommendations and coming up with the recommendations to stop having babies. This is
it just sounds desperate, like we don't know what else to do, so don't have babies until we can figure it out.
Yeah, exactly. I think we have to separate the times when ministers of health or politicians have been, you know, caught by the media and asked what can we do versus the recommendations that are actually developed by a ministry. And Brazil hasn't recommended not having babies. Mm-hmm. I think, first off, you have the problem that women can't always have control of their own fertility. And then you have the other problem of contracepting and still getting pregnant and a range of other issues. And also, if you were a woman at the end of your reproductive career, 37, 38 mm-hmm. years old or older, waiting 2 years could be the difference between having a baby and not having a baby. So I can't imagine this being a realistic recommendation.
So, Carl, step way back with us. You're our big health anthropologist here, so you must be thinking about, ever since this sort of boomed onto the public awareness, about how everyone's responding to it, about how Brazil has responded, how other countries in Latin America have responded, how the U.S., with its very active media, have responded, how we're responding to it right here today. What's going through your mind as you look at the challenge here from the Zika virus and how we might best tackle it, how people are tackling it?
Well, I think a lot of effort has gone into Aedes aegypti control, and I've been involved in that since the 70s, in fact. And it's really been a kind of tale of interest at times when there's a peak of dengue or now Zika or perhaps some other disease. But between these epidemics, everything goes back to normal. And normal is that we accept having this disease transmission mechanism go on and on and on and on. There was a time back in the 50s when Aedes aegypti was eliminated from Brazil and was reintroduced then in the 60s and 70s.
Why? And so how was it eliminated? Why was it reintroduced?
So it was eliminated through household inspection and inspection and control of breeding sites, a program done by a man named Fred Soper. And most of the countries in the Americas agreed to go along with this, but the U.S. did not. And so here it was thought that home inspection was a bit too far. And so
we harbored this Aedes aegypti and kept it viable?
Yeah, exactly. Great. But on the other hand, it was also in Asia and Africa. Mm-hmm. It was in other places. Eradication only works if you do it globally, like smallpox. It doesn't work if you have breeding sites someplace else. So this is a very tough mosquito that's changing its behavior, evolving to better parasitize us. And so for me, it's Lyle Peterson, who's a great authority on mosquito at CDC, on the 15th of January commented that he thought the peak of this epidemic in Brazil had passed. I don't know if that's true or not, but sooner or later it will. And I just wonder what will happen then when things go back to quote-unquote normal.
Megan, of course, concern about different diseases rises and falls, but when it has the potential for birth defect attached to it, and significant birth defect here, people can really get concerned. I know the American Mosquito Control Association has been meeting in Savannah just recently. Is there talk of trying to get a full-on global, you know, track it down and stamp it out effort on again for Aedes? We came close at one point, Carl is reminding us.
Well, I think what's interesting is that, you know, we had some issues with dengue and chikungunya, and chikungunya doesn't kill like dengue does. But to be honest, I am a little surprised that now with Zika, and because our children are affected, I guess I'm not surprised, I suppose, but this is really lit a fire, I guess, under people, more so than things that have been going on for decades. So I don't know if that's really going to happen, and it didn't happen with dengue. So I'm a little skeptical, I suppose.
Boy, this time, though, economic factors come into play, and if you start seeing these birth defects moving into more countries, moving into this country. Daniel in Hialeah, Florida. Daniel, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hey, Tom. I'm calling because I'm a little shocked at the cynicism against contraception and educating people in general. To at least refrain for a period of time. I mean, it sounds
like... there's no cynicism. It's just the question about, you know, imagine yourself in a village somewhere where there's not a lot of contraception, where maybe abortion is not even legal.
Naturally. Well, so that's where education and family planning can take place from other organizations, from international organizations, as opposed to this attempt to eradicate an insect that can breed virtually anywhere through a spreading of pesticides, which affects everybody, as opposed to the Zika virus, which affects a small population of people that can be controlled.
But it's a pretty important population, Daniel, and sooner or later, many people are going to want to have children.
But now there's also the high immunity rate for Zika. Once you contract Zika, you have a very high immunity towards it. Is it? I'm pretty sure that was put on NPR not too long ago. So if there's a period here where people refrain or where there's intelligent use of contraception, and either within that period of time we have vaccination or people develop an immunity to it, might then we have kind of a solution that's a little more natural, that kind of, you know, takes place without dropping a hammer on a very, 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 very tiny problem.
Well, I like the way you're thinking. I wish it could be so. Andrew, what about it? What if we just live with this for a while and we develop a kind of herd immunity through, you know, people get it and get over it, and is that possible?
It certainly is possible. In other places, such as the Yapa Islands and in Polynesia, it seems like there have been one major outbreak and then very limited cases afterwards. That would imply that once you get infected, you may be protected from a subsequent infection, and that may change the whole nature of how this virus causes disease in future years. It's something that we just don't know about right now. And as you mentioned, we're talking about a very special population here, a very vulnerable population. So right now, I think there's a lot of caution and a lot of care that wants to be taken to make sure that everything that we're doing, everything is possible to limit this disease there.
One more quick call. Sandy in Houghton, Michigan. Sandy, you're on. Our time is short. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Just a quick question. I'd like to know if anyone knows how the Catholic Church is going to feel about millions of its followers in Central and South America being told to use birth control.
Birth control, and maybe if the microcephaly shows up, even abortion could be part of this picture. Carl, what about that front?
The Catholic Church has, in Brazil at least, has accepted certain malformations and congenital malformations like acephaly as a reason for abortion. I don't think there's going to be rapid change here, either in Central America or in Latin America. And at the same time, I think people are going to be making their decisions about contracepting or not contracepting pretty independent of the Church's recommendations.
Is contraception widely available in Central America, Catholic countries there?
Yes, there's different kinds of contraception, but it's normally part of drug distribution programs.
So that part's there if you've got the money and the access and the cooperation to have it and use it. The learning curve here is steep, and we all have the feeling, I'm sure, that there's a lot more to come. This has been a very useful session with the three of you today, and we are grateful for it. Carl Kendall at Tulane University, School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine, Director of the Center for Global Health Equity there. Carl, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Andrew Pekosh at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Thanks for being here, Andrew.
My pleasure.
And Megan Wise de Valdez at Texas A&M in San Antonio, Texas. Megan, thank you very much for your insights today.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.